Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speaker is Greg Bowman. And Greg will be speaking on Shakespeare, Villains and Outsiders. So let's listen in.
I'm going to begin with a joke that has absolutely nothing to do with villains and outsiders. This is a joke that goes back to the source, I believe, is Joe Papp. I heard it from my Shakespeare teacher, who had heard it, I think, from somebody who probably heard it from Joe Papp. But Joe Papp was a longtime runner of the Shakespeare Festival in New York, and one day it seemed that he was short an extra, and he had a friend in the area that he wanted to get into the play, who'd said that he'd like to be on stage if anything ever arose. So he quickly gave him a call. The guy lived out in Connecticut, and he said, "I have this small part for you. Can you come in and do it?" And the guy said, that depends. What's the line?" He says, "Very easy. All you have to say is, 'Hark, I hear the cannons roar.'" It's one from one of the history plays. I couldn't even tell you which one. And he says, "I think I can do that." "Okay, hark, I hear the cannons roar." He put the phone down. He's practicing his line. "Hark, I hear the cannons roar." No, that's not right. "Hark, I hear the cannons roar." No, that's too much. "Hark, I hear the cannons roar." He gets dressed. He gets out and hails a taxi. "Hark, I hear the cannons roar." He's practicing all the way through the cab ride in New York. "Hark, I hear the cannons roar. Hark, 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 I hear the cannons roar." And he gets out of the taxi cab. They slap a costume on him and put makeup on him. And while they're dabbing his face, he says, "Hark, I hear the cannons roar. Hark, I hear the cannons roar." They slap this costume on him. They shove him out on stage. And he's there with a bunch of other peoples. And the cannons in the wing goes, "Boom, boom, boom." And he says, "What the hell was that?" All right, Shakespeare villains. Well, Siskel and Ebert say that the best part about a movie is the villain. It takes a good villain to make a good movie. So much so that I have these weird reactions sitting into these audiences and actually hearing people in movie audiences cheer the villain. If any of you have ever seen The Silence of the Lambs, a very, very disturbing movie. There's a character in there named Hannibal the Cannibal, Hannibal Lecter, who was a sociopath who murdered a lot of people and ended up eating them. He has the very last line in the movie. He escapes by the end of the movie, and the last line, he calls up this agent who has been working with him, essentially trying to catch somebody else throughout the whole movie. He calls her up, and at the end of the movie, he says, "I have to go now. I'm inviting an old friend for dinner." And you see this other antagonist who's been really a jerk through the whole movie that he somehow managed to lure into his trap. And that's how the movie ends. And the most disturbing thing about this is that the audience laughs and cheers at this line. I mean, they can't stand the guy so much that the prospect of him actually being served as somebody's dinner is funny and disturbing in some ways. Shakespeare doesn't have that, although he does have cannibalism, as we discussed on Monday. There are some disturbing scenes in Shakespeare, but his villains don't get that bad. I just want to look at some villains, though, and ask ourselves, first of all, what makes a character a villain? Second of all, how Shakespeare developed in his portrayal of villains, and third of all, whether or not these villains are still villains today. One of the things about Shakespeare is that he sometimes chose villains who were easy targets from certain ethnicities, from certain religions. He called these traditional villains, which today tends to be more of a problem than they were in his time. And this goes back to my point last time, yesterday, I believe, when I said that Shakespeare may not be as timeless as people like to say. All right, well, we'll start with his very first villains. For the most part, actually, you can trace the development of Shakespeare's plays just in the development of the villain. In a lot of Shakespeare's earlier plays, the plot revolves around a confusion that is somehow sorted out by the end of the play. The Comedy of Errors just has a bunch of mistaken identities that by the end of the play they're all sorted out, everybody's happy, and that's your play. As Shakespeare developed, he got more and more into the idea of the villain, and develop the villains more. So for the most part, the earlier plays don't have villains. If you think about Romeo and Juliet, which the plot might be familiar to most of you, I'm thinking, you can't really find a villain in the play. Tybalt, you know, is a jerk, but he's not necessarily a villain. It's mostly a tragedy of misunderstanding rather than a tragedy of villainy. This is not true in the later plays. Even in the comedies, the later plays really have very, very nasty villains. The only play that this doesn't hold true for is Titus Andronicus, which some believe to be his first play, and this does have a villain in it, and I'd like to look at that again. We looked at this a little bit on Monday. Aaron, yes, a lot of disgusting things that go on in Titus Andronicus, but Aaron is the main villain, and I want to look at him primarily as a precursor of Iago in some respects, and just see what the depth is of a villainy in Shakespeare's earlier plays. The scene that I want to start with is Act 5, Scene 2. So most of the carnage has already taken place. Aaron, at this point, Act 5, Scene 2 of Titus Andronicus, and actually, is it 5-2 I want? It might be 5-1. Yes, it is 5-1, I'm sorry. Aaron has, at this point, already had an affair with Queen Tamora and had a baby from that affair, and he's stolen the baby, killed the nurse, and killed the midwife to try to prevent the spread of the knowledge of this baby being spread. And then he's caught by Lucius, who's the main good guy with an army of the Goths, and this is the exchange that Lucius has. Lucius is Titus Andronicus's son. Actually, at this point, it's his only son remaining. And he's caught by Lucius, and this is the tale that he gives. We'll start somewhere around line 53. Can somebody read Lucius, and I'll be Aaron? I'll volunteer for Lucius. Okay, Matt, thanks. I hope these texts are the same. Titus Andronicus is one of the more problematic plays, but it shouldn't be too much problem. I'm going to start with Lucius Save the Child. Do you see where that is? Line 53 or so?
Yeah.
Okay. Lucius, save the child, and bear it from me to the Empress. If thou do this, I'll show thee wondrous things that highly may advantage thee to hear. If thou wilt not, befall what may befall, I'll speak no more, but vengeance rot you all.
Stay on, and if it please me, which thou speaks, the child shall live, and I will see it nourished.
And if it please thee, why, assure thee, Lucius, 'twill vex thy soul to hear what I shall speak. For I must talk of murders, rapes, and massacres, acts of black night, abominable deeds, complots of mischief, treasons, villainies, ruthful to hear, yet piteously performed. And this shall all be buried in my death, unless thou swear to me my child shall live.
Tell all my mind. I say thy child shall live.
Swear that he shall, and then I will begin.
Who would I swear by? Thou believest no God, that grantest. That granted, how canst thou believe an oath?
What if I do not? And as indeed I do not, yet for I know thou art religious, and hast a thing within thee called conscience, with 20 popish tricks and ceremonies, which I have seen thee careful to observe. Therefore I urge thy oath, for that I know an idiot holds his bauble for a god, and keeps his oath, which by that god he swears. To that I'll urge him. Therefore thou shalt vow by that same god, what god soe'er it be, that thou adorest and hast in reverence, to save my boy, to nourish, and bring him up, or else I will discover naught to thee.
Even by my god I swear to thee, I will.
First know thou, I begot him on the empress.
O most insatiate and luxurious woman!
Tut, Lucius, this was but a deed of charity to that which thou shalt hear of me anon. 'Twas her two sons that murdered Bassanius. They cut her sister's tongue, and ravished her, and cut her hands, and trimmed her as thou sawest.
Oh, detestable villain! Call'st thou that trimming?
Why, she was washed, and cut, and trimmed, and 'twas trim sport for them which had the doing of it.
Oh, barbarous, beastly villains, like thyself.
Indeed, I was their tutor to instruct them. That coddling spirit had they from their mother, as sure as a card as ever won the set. That bloody mind I think they learned of me, as true a dog as ever fought at head. Well, let my deeds be witness of my worth. I trained thy brethren to that guileful hole where the dead corpse of Bassanius lay. I wrote the letter that thy father found and hid the gold within the letter that letter mentioned, and confederate with the queen and her two sons, and what not done, thou hast not caused a rue wherein I had no stroke of mischief in it. I played the cheater for thy father's hand, and when I had it, drew myself apart and almost broke my heart with extreme laughter. I pried me through the crevice of a wall, when for his hand he had his two sons' head, beheld his tears, and laughed so heartily that both mine eyes were rainy like to his. And when I told the empress of this sport, she sounded almost at my pleasing tale, and for my tidings gave me 20 kisses. Go ahead and read the...
What, canst thou say all this and never blush?
I like a black dog, as the saying is.
Art thou not sorry for these heinous deeds?
Aye, that I had not done 1,000 more. Even now I curse the day, and yet I think few come within the compass of my curse. Even now I curse the day wherein I did not some notorious ill, as kill a man, or else devise his death, ravish a maid, or plot the way to do it, accuse some innocent, and forswear myself, set deadly enemy between two friends, make poor men's cattle break their necks, set fire on barns and haystacks in the night, and bid the owners quench them with their tears. Oft have I dug up dead men from their graves and set them upright at their dear friend's door, even when their sorrows almost were forgot, and on their skins, as on the bark of trees, have with my knife carved in Roman letters, "Let not your sorrow die, though I am dead." But I have done 1,000 dreadful things, and as willingly as one would kill a fly, and nothing grieves me heartily indeed, but that I cannot do 10,000 more.
Bring down the devil, for he must not die so sweet a death as hanging presently.
If there be devils, would I were a devil, to live and burn in everlasting fire, so I might have your company in hell, but to torment you with my bitter tongue.
Sir, stop his mouth and let him speak no more.
Okay. Did you notice the convention here? Sir, stop his mouth. That's something we came across yesterday. It was one way that men have in these plays of shutting up women. It's the same thing that he says here. Sir, stop his mouth. I didn't go over the plot. I went over this on Monday, but you can sort of get the plot in a nutshell here of what's been happening. Essentially, Aaron has conspired to have the main character, Titus Andronicus' daughter, ravished, then have her tongue cut out, her hands cut off. She killed her husband, Bassanius, and then blamed Titus's other two sons for it and had them murdered. And in the process, Titus lost his hand because he said, "I'd give my hand to save them." And Aaron said, "Oh, yeah, sure, I'll take your hand," and then brought back his two heads as part of that. So this is a very, very nasty person. And yet this is supposed to be a humorous line. I've seen this portrayed, and people just laugh at this. When he says, "Oft have I digged up dead men from their graves and set them upright at their dear friend's door." You have to wonder the mentality of this guy who digs up people from their graves and set them at people's door. It's almost like it's a prank, but it's a real sick, sick prank. And yet, yeah, we're laughing at this. You just wonder. Well, Shakespeare, do you see how this, in some sense, this prefigures Iago, except that Iago isn't... I don't think he's as overt about this. You know what I'm saying? I think Iago would stoop to this level, but
he wouldn't boast.
But he wouldn't boast about it. And I'll get to the scene where he says too. You know, I'm going to be silent now. And then there's Aaron's final speech. I also went over this on Monday, but this is the very last end of the play, Act 5, Scene 3, the second to the last speech, where Aaron says, "What wrath, what should wrath be mute and fury dumb? I am no baby I, that with base prayers I should repent the evils that I have done. 10,000 worse than ever yet I did would I perform if I might have my will. If one good deed in all my life I did, I do repent it from my very soul. If I did one good deed in my life, I do repent it from my very soul."
One thing about a lot of Shakespeare's villains, they seem to enjoy being evil just mm-hmm. for its own sake.
Yeah, they do enjoy being...
No other motivation, it's just... Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They do enjoy being evil for its own sake, and yet, and now I'm bringing in the monkey wrench to throw into this. This scene started out how? He wanted to save his son.
Yeah.
He wouldn't tell anything unless he would... secure the safety of his son, this ill-begotten son that actually the queen wanted to kill, but he killed in order to save this son. This to me adds depth to the villainy. I mean, this adds character to the villainy, even though this is in Shakespeare's evil one of Shakespeare's early plays. The evilness portrayed here isn't entirely evil. You know what I'm saying?
It's not total.
It's not total evil, because he could have had him say these nasty things and perform these nasty things. So why add this bit with the son?
He's 99 3/10 evil.
Yeah. Or if you want to be Ivory Soap, 99.44 1/100.
Yeah.
Yes. Why add this bit with the son? It doesn't seem to add anything to the plot. It's not necessary, other than to give him an excuse not to talk or a bargaining chip. But I just find this interesting. All right, let's go on to Iago. And since we talked about him, this is Iago's
Would that be in the first or the second volume?
This is an Othello. The play is Othello. The thing about Aaron as a villain, Aaron, by the way, is a Moor. I didn't bring that out. Which is one way that this is linked with Othello, except that Othello is Othello is the dupe in this case. The Moor is the dupe and not the villain. But these are the only two Moors that appear in Shakespeare's play, I believe. There might be another that I can't think of off the top of my head. The difference in these plays is that Aaron's villainy comes afterwards. We sort of see what he does, ascribe him to be a villain, and then hear him brag about it afterwards. For Iago, it comes right from the start. This is Act 1, Scene 1. Shakespeare uses the device Iago talking to Rodrigo, and in the process he can also talk to the audience and tell the audience exactly what kind of a character he is. I was going to go in the middle of this, but why don't we start right at the beginning? Does somebody else want to read Iago for a variety? Since you know the play, would you like to?
I didn't hear where the reference was, I'm sorry.
Very beginning of Othello.
At the beginning?
Yes.
It's too hard to read.
Okay. Yeah, the light in here isn't exactly the best.
First
seven. Actually, starting at the beginning, I'll read Rodrigo. Okay? You'll notice the immediacy of the scene. Shakespeare does this. He acts as if the beginning of the play is right in the middle of a conversation. So Rodrigo rushes in and says, "Tush, never tell me. I take it much unkindly that thou, Iago, who hast had my purse, as if the strings were thine, shouldst know of this."
"'Sblood, do not hear me. If ever I did dream of such a matter, abhor me."
"Thou told'st me thou didst hold him in thy hate."
"Despise me if I do not. 3 great ones of the city, in personal suit, make me his lieutenant. Off cap to him, and by the faith of man I know my price. I am worth no worse than place. But he is loving his own pride and purposes, evades them with a bombast circumstance, horribly stuffed with epithets of war. Not suits my views. For since, he says he, I have already chose my officer, and what was he? Forsooth, the greater arithmetician. One Michael Cassio, a Florentine, a fellow almost damned and a fair wife, that never set a squadron in the field, nor the division of a battle knows more than a spinster. Unless the bookish theoric, when the togged councils can propose, as masterly as he. Mere prattle without practice is all his soldiership, but he, sir, had the election, and I, of whom his eyes had seen the proof at Rhodes, at Cyprus, and on other grounds, Christian and heathen, must be led and calmed, my debitor and creditor. This countercaster, he in good time must his lieutenant be, and I, God bless the mark, his moorship's ensign."
Yes, This is a little more complicated than other Shakespeare's passages. Could you follow along exactly what was being said in this? He didn't get the job he wanted. He didn't get promoted.
And the office guy got it.
And the office guy got it, exactly. This is one time where he wanted to say, out with it, Will. What are you talking about? And I can even, there are many cruxes in Shakespeare where scholars are just, what in the world is going on here? And this is one of them where, I sort of like to think that yes, Will did make a mistake. He sometimes didn't know where he was going. When he describes Michael Cassio, he says, Michael Cassio is a Florentine, a fellow almost damned and a fair wife. Meaning that he's I hate him all the more because he has a fair wife, is essentially what this line means. And if you know the plot of Othello, you know that it centers around Michael Cassio having, or Othello thinking that Cassio is having an affair with Desdemona, which I suppose he could be doing if he had a wife, but later on in the play, I think it's very clear that Cassio was single and was trying to court Desdemona before Othello came into the picture. And so here Shakespeare either made a mistake, or it's something that we don't quite know what he means, or I tend to think it's just a mistake. He thought that Cassio should have a wife, and then later on he thought he didn't. But at any rate, back to Iago, his villainy is disclosed right from the beginning. He hates Othello, he hates Cassio, and the audience, in this case, rather than seeing the deeds and trying to discover who's behind them or what the motivation is, we see the motivation and wait with anticipation what the deeds are going to be. We never, from this moment on, then trust Iago. And it's the horror movie syndrome where you see the character open the door and the people shout at the screen and they say, "Don't do it!" You know, you don't want to do it. You almost want to shout at Othello, you know, "Why are you being so stupid?" Because we share a knowledge that Othello doesn't, and it's very frustrating, in some senses, for the audience to go through this. And it makes Iago all the more a villain because everything that we see, you can hear, if you've ever seen this play performed, has anybody seen this performed? You can almost hear the audience at certain parts responding, you know, or, you know, that type of thing when they see this going on. Well, I don't want to go through exactly what the villainy is, just what type of villain he is, but I do want to touch on the last scene. Again, this is Act 4, Scene 2, Act 5, Scene 2. To contrast this with Aaron, I think this makes this, you know, even more contemptible, although, as I said, you don't really need it as much in this play because you see what Iago does. Iago's last line is about line 300 or so. This is going to vary in different texts because the amount of prose makes the text line numbers change. But about line 300, Iago's last line, when Othello says, after Cassio says, "General, I never gave you cause," Othello says, "I do believe it." After all this disaster, you know, Othello finally recognizes that Cassio wasn't trying to trick him, that Othello, was a dupe of Iago. Othello apologizes, says, "I do believe it, and I ask your pardon." Turns to Iago and says, "Will you, I pray, demand that demi-devil why he has thus ensnared my soul and body?" And Iago's response is, "Demand me nothing. What you know, you know. From this time forth, I will never speak a word." And that's his last line. And this, I think, you know, I always found it unrealistic in, say, an Agatha Christie mystery novel or some other mystery novel when the villain suddenly gets loquacious and says, "Yes, I did it, and this is how," and blah, blah, blah. Not that I know too many villains who do otherwise. But this, to me, seems all the more ominous, you know. Saying, "Yeah, okay, I'm caught, but I'm not going to tell you why. I'm not going to say anything more." And just let everybody else wonder.
A little different from Aaron.
Exactly, very different from Aaron, who it seems is almost begging to let his deeds come out. So if Aaron was a precursor to Iago, at least in being a behind-the-scenes manipulator, Shakespeare had some different ideas as to what goes on in when he's finally caught in this play.
Maybe you're getting to the city seems like Don John and Much Ado About Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
He just flees. Yes. I mean, he never has a significant last line.
Right. As a matter of fact, in the Branagh production, mm-hmm. Don John comes back, but that's added. In Shakespeare, it's just like, he's been caught, we'll deal with him later.
Right.
I was going to do some of Don John, but I showed so much of Much Ado yesterday that I thought,
okay,
I'd get away from Don John. But that's a good point, exactly. He just flees, he leaves.
There's never any explanation of why he wanted to put that marriage.
Right. Other than the fact that it might be something with his humors and he's just out of sorts. just a general nasty guy. Yeah, having a bad day. The other thing about Iago not giving an explanation is that we've already seen his deeds. We don't necessarily need an explanation as much as we might with Aaron. Although in that case, we have seen some of the deeds as well. So
I think his character is more, if you can't figure it out, that just makes him superior. Mm-hmm. And that's he's on a superiority trip mm-hmm. at this point.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't get it, that's your problem.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I'll never top cover.
Yeah, try to figure me out. And really, I think, I do believe this is Iago's play. It's not named Iago because you don't name a play after the villain. But I essentially think that this is Iago's play. This is more of a character study in Iago than it is really in Othello. Although that's just my opinion. Onward and upward. I'm getting to a non-traditional villain now. This is in Julius Caesar. Again, this is another earlier play. This happens actually earlier than Othello. Yes, I'm making you switch books by going back and forth, aren't I? I'm characterizing Mark Antony as a villain in this play, and this is an unusual characterization because Mark Antony, in some respects, comes across as the center. I mean, once Julius Caesar has been killed, it's Mark Antony who assumes power and sort of seizes the moment. But Mark Antony has done some things that recent criticism in this play has found kind of disturbing. And it ties back. I'll look at his central speech, and then I'll get to another speech after that. The center of the play, 3-2. By the way, if you want to know the key to Shakespeare, always look in the center of the play. Usually, in the center of Act 3 is Act 3 out of a 5-act play is where the main turning point is, the main action. You know, the tempting scene in Othello where Othello goes from true devotion to believing that his wife has been unfaithful is Act 3, scene 2, I believe. But anyways, it's the center of the play again. Here, the center of the play, after Caesar has been killed and Brutus has sort of appealed to the populace and said, you know, I did it, I'm sorry, but look, Caesar had to be killed. He was ambitious. We had to do something about it. And they say, you know, yes, Brutus, we agree. And then Brutus has agreed to let Mark Antony come on the stage. Now, earlier in the play, Antony has sort of expressed regret as to what has happened to Caesar, and he didn't want to join the rebels. And this is his famous speech. This begins line 73 or so. His famous speech where he's talking to the crowd and at the same time having ironic undertones of what exactly he's trying to say. Remember, he's been allowed to speak at Brutus's consent. Brutus has said, okay, go ahead, you can explain our motives to them. We're going to leave and we're going to go off and bury the body. And the opening of the speech at least should sound familiar. Friends, this is line 73 or so, Act 3, Scene 2. Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is often tarred with their bones. So let it be with Caesar. The noble Brutus hath told you Caesar was ambitious. If it were so, it was a grievous fault, and grievously hath Caesar answered for it. Here, under leave of Brutus and the rest, for Brutus is an honorable man, so are they all honorable men, come I to speak in Caesar's funeral. He was my friend, faithful and just to me, but Brutus says he was ambitious, and Brutus is an honorable man. He hath brought many captives home to Rome, whose ransoms did the general coffers fill. Did this in Caesar seem ambitious? When that the poor have cried, Caesar hath wept. Ambition should be made of sterner stuff. Yet Brutus says he was ambitious, and Brutus is an honorable man. You all did see that on the Lupercal, I thrice presented him with a kingly crown, which he thrice did refuse. Was this ambition? Yet Brutus says he was ambitious, and sure he is an honorable man. I speak not to disprove what Brutus spoke, but here am I to speak what I do know. You all did love him once, not without cause. What cause withholds you then to mourn from him? O judgment, thou art fled to brutish beasts, and men have lost their reason. Bear with me, my heart is in the coffin there with Caesar, and I must pause till it come back to me. And the crowd at this point says, I don't know. You sort of hear these rumblings. I really can't do this speech justice. I'm not as good of an actor, but you can sort of see that Antony is just playing the crowd as well as he can.
He is an honorable man.
Yeah, he is an honorable man. And to weep at this point, you know, I'm sorry, I've lost myself. I've misspoke, you know. And then that lets the crowd rumble. I'm not sure what's going on here. Antony goes on. Yesterday the word of Caesar might have stood against the world. Now lies he there, and none so poor to do him reverence. Oh, masters, if I were disposed to stir your hearts and minds to mutiny and rage, I should do Brutus wrong and Cassius wrong, who, you all know, are honorable men. I will not do them wrong. I rather choose to wrong the dead, to wrong myself and you. Then I will wrong such honorable men. But here's a parchment with the seal of Caesar. I found it in his closet. 'Tis his will. Let but the commons hear this testament, which, pardon me, I do not mean to read, and they would go and kiss Caesar's dead wounds and dip their napkins in his sacred blood, yea, beg a hair of him for memory, and dying, mention it within their walls, bequeath it as a rich legacy unto their issue. And the common men go, oh, yes, the will, let's hear the will. And he says, have patience, gentle friends, I must not read it. Yeah, right. Okay. It is not meet you should know how Caesar loved you. You are not wood, you are not stones, but men. And being men, hearing the will of Caesar, it will inflame you, it will make you mad. 'Tis good you know not what. Are his heirs. 'Tis good that you know not that would that you are his heirs. You know, isn't that that's a device? Oh shoot, I learned this in Latin. I can't remember what the device is. I just learned it as the mother-in-law device, where you say, and I will not mention the fact that, and then you go ahead and mention it. But anyways, he says, 'tis good that you should not know that you are his heirs, for if you should, oh, what would come of it? And they're all by this point saying, read the will, read the will, read the will. Anyway, he goes on, talks more about Caesar, and then finally, at the end of this scene, he reads the will. This is almost 100 lines later, you see, at 241. Here's the will, and under Caesar's seal, to every Roman citizen he gives, to every several man, 75 drachmas. And then they say, oh, most noble Caesar, we'll revenge his death. Oh, royal Caesar, hear me with patience. Moreover, he hath left you with all his walks, his private arbors, and newly planted orchards on this side Tiber. He hath left them to you, and to your heirs forever, common pleasures to walk abroad and recreate yourselves. Here was a Caesar. When comes such another? And they all, and at this point, they're in a frenzy, and they're going, and then... And then when they leave with the body, this is where Antony reveals his true character. He says, now let it work. Mischief thou art afoot. Take thou what course thou wilt. You know, he is, I think, the true Machiavellian. He plays the crowd for what the crowd wants. Gets his own devices. And then in a private moment, this is not one scene later. This is Act 4, Scene 1. This is the mafia scene. Okay, Antony, Octavius, and Lepidus, who will form the triumvirate after Caesar, get together, and Antony says, these many then shall die. Their names are pricked. Pricked meaning they have a sheet here, and then they take a pin or a nail or something and prick it, you know, mark it. Octavius says, your brother too must die. Consent you, Lepidus? Lepidus says, I do consent. Prick him down, Antony, upon condition that Publius shall not live, who is your sister's son, Mark Antony. And Antony says, he shall not live. Look, with a spot, I damn him. But Lepidus, go you to Caesar's house, fetch the will hither, and we shall determine how to cut off some charges, some charge in legacies. Okay, this is the behind-the-scenes finagling. And this, to me, I think, just really shows Antony's true character. Okay, you say he'll die, I'll agree to it on the condition that you die. Okay, and I'll agree to it on the condition that your friend dies. And they're trying to, you know, do essentially this purge. You know? And then when Lepidus leaves, Antony says, this is a slight, unmeritable man, meet to be sent on errands. Is it fit that threefold world divided, he should stand as one of the three to share it? And Octavius says, so you thought him. And took his voice, who should be pricked to die in our black sentence and prescription. And Antony says, Octavius, I have seen more days than you. And though we lay these honors on this man, to ease ourselves of divers slanderous loads, he shall but bear them as the ass bears gold. To groan and sweat under the business, either led or driven, as we point the way. Having brought our treasure where we will, then we take down his load and turn him off, like to the empty ass, to shake his ears and graze in commons. This to me is pretty nasty. Again, pretty Machiavellian. But yet, it wasn't but 10, 15 years ago you would read criticisms of Julius Caesar and talk about Mark Antony as the moral center, the person who brings together everything after Julius Caesar has been killed and sort of, you know, restores order in typical Shakespearean fashion. But I do find Mark Antony as pretty Machiavellian. Another thing that I'm going to look at in along the same lines is Macbeth. No question, I think that Macbeth is a villain in his own play. And here we do have a play named after him, so I guess I'm proved wrong. We should have named Othello Iago, I guess. But I'm not so sure. When I first was taught Shakespeare, I was taught that Duncan the King, who is Macbeth's first murder victim. Sorry if I gave it away for you if you don't know Macbeth. Duncan is the king, who is Macbeth's murder victim. The murder is made all the more horrible because Duncan is portrayed as being gracious. You know, Duncan is a gracious king. And I want to find some fault with that and portray Duncan again as being Machiavellian in the same sense that Mark Antony is Machiavellian. Sorry if I'm destroying any heroes here. Look at Act 1, Scene 2 of Macbeth. A sergeant comes in to give a report from war, and Duncan says, "What bloody man is that? He can report, as seemeth by his plight, of the revolt, the newest state." Now here's a man coming from battle who's bloody, and by the end of the scene he will need his wounds attending to, but Duncan, first of all, wants his report. Yeah, we'll get you to a surgeon later, but give me your report. And he gives his report that merciless MacDonald, worthy to be a rebel, for to that the multiplying villainies of nature do swarm upon him, from the western isles of Kerns and gallow glasses is supplied. And fortune on his damned quarrel smiling showed like a rebel's whore. But all is too weak for brave Macbeth, disdaining fortune with his brandished steel, which smoked with bloody execution, carved out his passage till he faced the slave, which never shook hands nor bade farewell to him, till he unseamed him from the nave to the chops and fixed his head upon our battlements. Couple of things in here. First of all, Macbeth is fighting MacDonald in the Western Isles. Now, if you know anything about Scotland, you know that the Western Isles are in the West. I say that because a scene is coming up where there's another battle in Fife, which is in the East. Okay, St. Andrews is in Fife. That's in the East. The Western Isles are in the West. Okay, Macbeth is in the West fighting MacDonald. And he kills MacDonald too. This is an aside. This doesn't have to do anything to do with villainy. But he kills MacDonald with a blow that unseamed him from the nave to the chops. This is an upside down cross. This is a backwards cross. He unseams him from the nave to the chops and then beheads him, which is symbolic. And Shakespeare's audience is going to pick up on this. This is symbolic of an upside down cross. Right away, this tells you Macbeth, wrong, bad guy, boo hiss when he comes on stage. He goes on, he sends the sergeant finally to the sergeants and enter Ross and Angus. Now the key here is to remember that Ross, if you know anything about the play, Ross is Macduff's man. Ross is a friend of Macduff, not Macbeth. Okay? Now Ross comes in and Malcolm says, "The worthy thane of Ross, Lennox, look what haste through his eyes. So should he look that seems to speak strange things. God save the king," says Ross. Duncan, "Whence camest thou, worthy thane?" Ross, "From Fife." Remember, Fife is in the East. "From Fife, great king, where the Norwegian banners flout the sky and fan our people cold. Norway himself, with terrible numbers, assisted by that most disloyal traitor, the Thane of Cawdor, began a dismal conflict
till that B'Elanna's bridegroom, lapped in proof, confronted him with the self-comparisons, point against point, rebellious arm against arm, curbing his lavish spirit, and to conclude, the victory fell on us. Now, I have a footnote in the Riverside edition, which is still considered to be, by many, the authoritative text. I have a footnote, B'Elanna's bridegroom, i.e. Macbeth. Macbeth is not in Fife. Macbeth is in the Western Isles. And here is Ross, who is Macduff's man, saying, till that B'Elanna's bridegroom, you know, that warrior, essentially, it's a conceit for that warrior. I believe here that he is referring to Macduff. He says, until Macduff, lapped in proof, confronted him with self-comparisons, point against point, rebellious arm against arm, curbing his lavish spirit, and to conclude, the victory fell on us. Great happiness. And Ross says, that now Sven, the Norway's king, craves composition, nor would we deign him burial of his men till he dispersed at St. Colm's Inch $10,000 to our general use. And Duncan, the king, replies, no more that Thane of Cawdor shall deceive our bosom interest. Go pronounce his present death, and with his former title, greet Macbeth. Okay, and Ross's, if this is played well, Ross's response, I believe, should be, I'll see it done. Okay, here he's just proclaimed great news of Macduff's victory, and Duncan says, oh, great, now we'll give his title to Macbeth. And Ross is like, okay, I'll see it done. And you have to remember, Ross is Macduff's man. He's Macduff's henchman. And this, I think, is showing Duncan playing, again, with what's... with the powers around him. He's wanting to surround himself with various people. He does the same thing, I believe, again, Act 1, Scene 4. This is where he names the Prince of Cumberland. Now, the Prince of Cumberland is the Scottish equivalent of the Prince of Wales, except that it's not traditional that it would go to the king's or the king's son. It can go to just about anybody that the king chooses. And so he hasn't named, just because the king has sons here, he hasn't necessarily named the Prince of Cumberland, named the person who's going to succeed him. And so he has this ceremony, and he makes a big deal about it, and he says, this is about line 35 or so, my plenteous joys, wanton in fullness, seek to hide themselves in drops of sorrow. Sons, kinsmen, thanes, and you whose places are the nearest, know we will establish our estate upon, and if this is played right, I think there should be a dramatic pause here. No, we should establish our estate upon, and you have the symbol of the Prince of Cumberland, which is probably a scepter or an orb or something, and he would pass over Macbeth and give it to his son. Okay, know that we will establish the Prince of Cumberland upon our eldest son, Malcolm. Macbeth could be worthy of this, and we've already been told that he will be the future king, but this is a big deal that he shows that, you know, he's granted favor with one hand, but he's going to grant a different favor with another hand. You see, he's sort of, in a sense, dispersing the power, dispersing favors among people in his train. Not necessarily the type of thing that you'd want to see from a king who you know, rewards for good deeds. He's rewarding more upon, you know, want to make sure that the power doesn't get too consolidated. I'm not saying that he deserved death. I'm just saying that he's got a little bit more behind him than might be thought. Another thing that I can say about Macbeth, too, while we're here, I've often read that Macbeth needed to be goaded into murder by his wife. He sort of had to be tempted, and in some cases, too, by the witches, he sort of had to be tempted to take the crown. I don't necessarily believe that this is true either. I think Macbeth had it in mind all along. And Shakespeare is wonderful in this way in that he provides this ambiguity, and you can sort of find this if you like. When Macbeth encounters the witches, and this is in the previous scene, Act 1, Scene 3, around line 50 or so, the witches hail him, you know, all hail Macbeth, Thane of Glamis, all hail Macbeth, hail to thee, Thane of Cawdor, all hail Macbeth, that shalt be king hereafter. And Banquo says, good sir, why do you start? And seem to fear things that do sound so fair. I think Macbeth starts because he's been thinking along these lines too. He's been thinking, well, you know, how can I best get the crown? And here these witches are reading his mind. They're not suggesting something to him, but they're reading his mind, and that startles him. And, good sir, why do you start and seem to fear things that sound so fair? And even before we have met his wife, too, you can also see that, that he's been plotting after the Prince of Cumberland episode, which is in the next scene. Macbeth, in an aside, says, "The Prince of Cumberland, that is a step on which I must fall down or else or leap, for in my way it lies." All right, the plot has already begun. Macbeth, but even before he's had this scene with his wife, has decided that something is in his way and has to be gotten rid of. Admittedly, I'm on tenuous ground here, but at least this is the way that I see the play and see some villainy, so feel free to comment or argue if you want to find something else. Well, going on again to some who have not been non-traditional villains, or I should say, I'm now more on origins of villains and what makes a person a villain. I don't want to say that I don't blame them for being villains, but on the other hand, I can sort of understand when some things come about. I want to look at the beginning of King Lear. The main villains in King Lear are essentially the two older daughters, Goneril and Regan, the bastard son, Edmund, who is not necessarily a villain because he's a bastard. There's a bastard in King John who becomes the moral center of the play and who does good things. But Edmund, Goneril and Regan, and Regan's husband, the Duke of Cornwall. But aside from the Duke of Cornwall, it's essentially those two. I want to look at the first scene and sort of deconstruct some things that happen here. It'd be nice to just have the first part of this read. Somebody want to be Kent, and somebody want to be Gloucester and Edmund, if I could have some readers.
Gloucester?
Want to be Gloucester? Can you be Edmund?
Sure.
Okay, I'll be Kent. I thought the king had more affected the Duke of Albany than Cornwall.
It had always seemed so to us, but now, in the division of the kingdom, it appears not which of the dukes he values most, for equalities are so weighed that curiosity in neither can make choice of either's moiety.
The key point here, but now in the division of the kingdom, he already knows about the division of the kingdom. Now keep this in mind as we go on. Is this not your son, my lord?
His breeding, sir, hath been at my charge. I have so often blushed to acknowledge him that now I am brazed to it.
I cannot conceive you.
Sir, this young fellow's mother could. Whereupon she grew round-wombed and had indeed, sir, a son for her cradle ere she had a husband for her bed. Do you smell a fault?
I cannot wish the fault undone, the issue of it being so proper.
But I have, sir, a son, by order of law, some year elder than this, who yet is no dearer in my account. Though this knave came something saucily into the world before he was sent for, yet was his mother fair. There was good sport at his making, and the horse son must be acknowledged. Do you know this noble gentleman, Edmund?
No, my lord.
My lord of Kent, remember him hereafter as my honorable friend.
My services to your lordship.
I must love you, sir, and soon to know you better.
Sir, I shall study deserving.
He hath been out 9 years, and away he shall again. The king is coming.
Okay, now, remember that Edmund is standing here while his father is essentially making a joke and saying, you know, such things as, yet his mother was fair, and there was good sport at his making, and, the horse must be acknowledged. Okay, and Edmund is standing here at the side while he has to listen to this. You know, I don't want to say that Edmund is excused, but on the other hand, I don't want to say that Gloucester is innocent. You know, there are some definite problems here, and you can sort of see the seeds of Edmund's villainy in the fact that he has to sit here and endure as his father introduces him to court in this fashion. Okay, now we go on to the Lear scene.
And I'm going to switch parts to Lear. And if, can somebody read the woman's parts?
Who's Cordelia as a woman?
Yeah, Cordelia, Goneril, and Regan.
Where are you going to start?
Where we left off.
Cordelia's the nice one.
Yeah, Cordelia's the nice one. Well, but still, I want to talk about this. We'll go on. I'll just go on.
She's bad too.
Lear sends Gloucester off stage. One of the things that happens in Lear is that Gloucester is always off stage when something seems to happen. He's never around. He comes back and he says, What's going on? What's happening? Lear sends Gloucester off stage and he says, yeah, what the hell was that? And Lear says, meantime, we shall express our darker purpose. Give me the map there. Know that we have divided in three our kingdom, and 'tis our fast intent to shake all cares and business from our age, conferring them on younger strength while we, unburdened, crawl towards death. Our son of Cornwall and you, our no less loving son of Albany, we have this hour a constant will to publish our daughter's several dowers, that future strife may be prevented now. Ha ha ha. Heavy on the irony, right? The princes France and Burgundy, great rivals in our young daughter's love, long in court have made their amorous sojourn, and here are to be answered. Tell me, my daughters, since now we will divest us both of rule, interest, and territory, cares of state, which of you, shall we say, doth love us most, that we our largest bounty may extend where nature doth with merit challenge? Goneril, our eldest born, speak first. Okay, several things here. First of all, he's a king giving up all the cares and duties of being a king, which in Shakespeare's time, you don't do that. Second of all, he's dividing the kingdom, which, you know, horrors. Their biggest fear was that England would be divided, that some of their conquered lands would be given up. I mean, that already happened with what happened with the fiasco in France. You know, they had different lands in French, and they gradually lost them until all they had was on the island. So, you know, dividing the kingdom is a big deal to them. And Goneril responds, somebody want to read
Sir,
this?
Sir, I love it more than words can will the matter. Dearer than eyesight, space, and liberty. Beyond what can be valued, rich or rare, no less than life, with grace, health, beauty, honor, as much as child ever loved or father found. A love that makes breath poor and speech unable, beyond all manner of so much I love you.
And Cordelia says, what shall Cordelia speak?
What shall Cordelia do?
Love and be silent. Yeah, Goneril, I love you more than words can wield the matter, and then she uses words anyway to bring this up. And then Lear responds, of all these bounds, even from this line to this, with shadowy forests and with champagnes riched, with plenteous rivers and wide-skirted meads, we make thee lady. What's wrong with this picture?
He's saying the woman over the land, it sounds like.
Well, he's giving her his lands, like he promised. He has not heard the other two speak, and he's already given, he said, okay.
Sounds good.
Sounds good, you get this portion. And he's going to do the same thing again with Regan. He says, what of our second daughter, our dearest Regan, wife of Cornwall? And she says,
I am made of that self metal as my sister, and prize me at her worth. In my true heart I find she names my very deed of love, only she comes too short, that I profess myself an enemy to all other joys which the most precious square of sense possesses, and find I am alone
felicitate
in your dear highness love.
Yeah, and find, you know, she doesn't say enough, even though she said just about everything that could be said. You know, I'm twice that. Me too is what she says. And Cordelia responds, you know, and poor Cordelia, yet not so, since I'm sure my love's more ponderous than my tongue. And Lear says, to thee and thine hereditary ever remain this ample third of our fair kingdom, no less in space, validity, and pleasure than that conferred on Goneril. Now our joy, although our last and least, to whose young love the vines of France and milk of Burgundy strive to be interest, what can you say to draw a third more opulent than your sister's? Speak. Okay, he's already divided this kingdom, and he's already decided what's going on. And we even get that in the very first lines, too, when Gloucester says, now in the division of kingdom, it appears that he values the dukes the same because he's given them. In other words, Gloucester knows how the kingdom has been divided and that that those two are going to get an equal part and that Cordelia is going to get a third more opulent than your sisters. And he says, speak.
Nothing, my lord.
Nothing?
Nothing
will come of nothing. Speak again. And of course, this is a great ironic line because everything comes from that nothing.
I'm happy that I am. I cannot heave my heart into my mouth. I love your majesty according to my bond. Not more, no more, no less.
How, Cordelia, mend your speech a little lest you mar your fortunes.
Good, my lord. You have begot me, bred me, loved me. I return those duties back as our right fit. Obey you, love you, and most honor you. Why have my sister's husbands if they say they love you all? Happily, when I shall wed, that lord whose hand must take my plight shall carry half my love with him, half my care and duty. Sure, I shall never marry like my sisters to love my father all.
Yeah, sure, I'm not going to marry like my sisters and still give my father all my love. I'm going to marry and give my husband half my love. Well, and then, of course, this starts the great disaster, which ends in the tragedy. And we'll look at this much more in depth tomorrow when we talk about redemption, because I think King Lear, more than any other play, talks about redemption. But I want to ask, in this first scene, do you find any... I mean, Cordelia has always been presented as the real, true, loving child. But do you find any sense that there might be some fault in this? I mean, certainly in Lear, but in Cordelia as well?
Well, she seems a little resentful. I mean, or she's just heard this opulence speech from one sister after another, mm-hmm. and she's like, I'm not buying into this, you know, mm-hmm. come on, Dad, this is too much, you know.
Yeah, this is...
You're manipulating me into saying this stuff.
Well, the key to this, I think, is that this is a public occasion. I mean, this is something, this is almost like saying, okay, I want you to declare publicly what needs to be done. And the fact that she doesn't go along publicly...
you it's know, like a slap in the face.
It almost is a slap in the face. But on the other hand, I mean, you know, I don't want to say that she's more blameless than Lear. You know, I think Lear causes his own downfall in this. But I also think that Cordelia, in some respects, is for a public occasion, is not performing it according to public mores. Now, feel free to argue with this. And this is a controversial point, but I at least see I can see Goneril and Regan being villains in this case because they have this sister whom their father just lavishes on attention, and essentially she's showing up the sisters. You know, she's saying, "Well, geez, my sisters. You know, they're even though they've studied these speeches. You know, this is rhetoric. It's." For the time, rhetoric was a way of studying speech that wasn't necessarily true. You know, you embellished your speech in some respects. And she's showing them up, and she's saying, "Well, they don't mean what they say." And so I can sort of see the seeds of villainy. You know, here.
Well,
I'm not necessarily.
Is it villainy
excusing
to
you.
Refuse to act like these sisters?
No, I'm not saying that that's villainy. I'm saying that I can understand why Goneril and Regan might be upset.
Perhaps Cordelia's fault is simply that she's not thinking ahead as to what could happen.
As to what the consequences are.
Don't do that!
Yeah.
But,
So, well, we can get more into this tomorrow. We don't have time. I was going to go to Merchant of Venice and look at the Hath Not a Jew Eyes speech. Because in many respects, a lot of what Shakespeare turns into villains are people that he is perceived to be different or outside the community in some way. And this is where I find that especially modern sensibilities would find Shakespeare problematic in that we don't necessarily want to view an outsider as villainous.
But sometimes it's a psychological fact that if you exclude somebody, you know, they can turn on you. Like, mm-hmm. Iago wanted to have this, what he thought was his due reward, but that he was excluded from that, perhaps. And if you're rejected and no one will accept you to the inner circle, then mm-hmm. you might end up getting your own thing going.
Yeah, again, not excusing villainy, but maybe understanding the seeds behind it. Yeah.
So just being an outsider can cause that.
Mm-hmm. And Shakespeare does have definite groups that he makes fun of. The other one I was going to look at that we didn't have time for was the Puritan in Twelfth Night, Malvolio, who was just ridiculed essentially for being a Puritan and made to look silly. That's the cross-gartering reference that I had made at lunchtime.